Alrighty, we are back here. We did have an answer for our trivia question. Brother Gary Cox got that right. So congratulations, Brother Gary Cox. What son of David was referred to as the son of Haggith? How do you say that, Miss Gretchen? Adoniah. There we go. I'm horrible with Hebrew names. I'm going to take a class one of these days on these. 1 Kings 1, 2, 2, and then Samuel 3, 4. Adoniah. All right. Well, we have Representative Miss Nancy Tate on the phone with us. Miss Nancy, how are you doing?
I am wonderful. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on Box 2 Radio this morning. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, well, we love having you on. I was excited when Mariah said we confirmed and got all that taken care of because I know there was some things happened in the session this year that I was excited to talk about. Now, is session over at this point?
No, right now we're in the veto period, which gives the governor the opportunity to look at all the bills that we've sent over on his desk.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll review those and he'll determine whether or not he wants to sign those, veto, or he can sign the bills into law, or he can do nothing. And if he does nothing, then the bills will go into law without his signature.
So what's some bills that were circulating around the general session this year that you're excited about, that maybe you had a part of? Some of them that may be disappointed they didn't go farther. I'm just curious from somebody who was there, what your take on it was.
Yeah, so it was a very interesting session. You know, every session has its own unique personality, right? And
mm-hmm.
so we went into the session cautiously optimistic. You know, we're certainly trying to change and define what we want Kentucky to look like. Obviously, our constituents, you guys, put us into office, and so therefore we're trying to model what we think is the desire of our constituents. And so from my perspective, I want to make Kentucky one of the most conservative, and I like to use the word healthy. I want to make Kentucky one of the most healthy states in the nation. I've changed using the word conservative because that really doesn't match what I'm not, you know, it's not Republican, it's not conservative, it's not liberal, it's healthy. And that's from a mental health, a physical health, a spiritual health, and a financial health. And so some of the bills that we've been working on for almost a year actually have been just churning really hard throughout this whole legislative session. And before I forget, I just want to do it to shout out State Representative Josh Calloway, who I know represents you all's district. And State Representative Josh Calloway, in my mind, was the most valuable player of the session this year.
Mm.
I don't know if you had the opportunity, but he gave one of the most heart-wrenching floor speeches I have heard in my tenure. And he begged leadership to give us the opportunity to take care of our children, to protect our children, to protect our children from the spiritual battle that we know is taking place. And we're, you know, and everyone is just begging, please take care of our children. And
yes.
He did that on the gave a floor speech. And, you know, I'm ashamed that I didn't get up and help him from that perspective. I apologize to him from that perspective. But I think that he did an absolute outstanding job. And there was really nothing else that I could think of that I could say to add to what he said. And he begged leadership, and he begged, you know, all of his peers to, you know, to take care of our children. He did an outstanding, outstanding job.
Wow. Yes. I mean, there is a real battle over our children right now. And I'm so thankful that we have people in Frankfort that's fighting for them, that's standing in the gap and really fighting the good fight. So praise the Lord for that. Thank you for sharing that with us too, because, you know, a lot of Kentuckians don't know exactly what goes on. And it's always informative and enlightening to know exactly what's going on, who's fighting, who's doing this. And that's great. So now there was a couple of bills that I had a question about that were, you heard in the background that I didn't hear necessarily exactly what was the finished product of it. Like considering, for one, the, you know, being able to allow guns onto college campuses. Did that go through? Did that not go through? And I know that was kind of hidden within another bill, kind of, so.
Yeah, so the way I understand that bill did not make it through. Now we're still trying to, honestly, we're still trying to figure out, you know, what happened. You know, the dust is still clearing. you know, after we passed language off the House, out of the House, which that was House Bill 254. Mm-hmm. Let me go back and look. House Bill 254 did not make it through the committees, even through the committees on the House. And so therefore, it was not even sent to the Senate.
Okay.
Yeah, but basically what that would have, like you said, that would have allowed guns to be on college campuses. We had so many college campuses, presidents of the college campuses reach out to us and just, you know, say that from their perspective, which is ironic, the individuals that are on their campus are not mature enough in order to have guns on campus. And the reason why I have to laugh is because they're not mature enough to have guns on campus, but they're mature enough to have all this other controversial issues, you know, on their campus. And I think, you know, as a society, it would be really great, and I know this will never happen, but it would be really great if we could ever decide, you know, how mature are our kids on college campus mature or are they not, and not pick and choose what social issues we want them to be mature on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always just seen it as such a dangerous, like, you know, whether it's a college campus. Now, I'm not telling you to let kids and stuff like have that, but like, you know, there seems to be that we could do better ways of protecting our campuses, because right now when we advertise these gun-free zones, it's like, hey, you bring something on and you just have free reign. I mean, because there's nothing that can stop you per se. There's no protection. And so I just think we have to figure out a way to do better in no way, form, or fashion. I'm not saying even like if you go to high school, you allow a kid to bring us something as protection. But, you know, at the end of the day, too, though, like having teachers better prepared, having some kind of game plan other than just, you know, lock a door. I don't know. I feel in my own heart that we have failed our children to an extent, and the college campuses as well.
Absolutely. And I'll just tell you, you know, whenever I was in high school, go all the way back to whenever I was in high school, you know, we had guns in the back of our, you know, in the back window of our trucks,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody, you know, most of us had, you know, I went to school, I rode to school with my brother, so all of us had guns, you know. And then not only that, but I just, from a female's perspective, I mean, I carry all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great neutralizer. You know, whenever I have my fanny pack on, people don't know what's in my fanny pack. But they should make the assumption that there's something in my fanny pack for me to be able to protect myself.
Sure.
And so it's just a great neutralizer, and it gives me the opportunity as a very small, weak, I'm just, you know, the older I get, the weaker I get, a female, it gives me the opportunity to be able to protect myself.
Yeah. As everybody should have that right to in reality. What's some things that you hope will start to be worked on from this point to next point, from this general session that is in the veto stage? So you'll have some things to do and cleaning up to do after that, but also moving into forward thinking of next year, what's some things that maybe did not make it through this year that you are going to rework on, or things that didn't even really get brought up that you think really needs to?
Yeah, well, I'm just going to, and you know, we didn't really talk about one of the things, and just for your listeners' perspective, Senate Bill 154, which was, you know, finally carried across from the, it was passed in the Senate, obviously. It was sent to the House, and then we took a lot of bills that had been all the way through the session. It had gone all the way through the session. It had gone from committee in House, through the House, into committee, into the Senate, but they just were not going to have the opportunity to vote on them in the Senate. Mm-hmm. We took Senate Bill 154, and we, in the House, put several bills and attached them to Senate Bill 150 and sent them back to the Senate to vote on. Now, everything that we did was, you know, you're going to hear all these people that say that, you know, in the, you know, the middle of the night, that we did this. Well, that's absolutely not true. Everything that we sent back on Senate Bill 150 was done legally. But it's really very interesting. The best part of it, you know, there's so many different parts, and you know, we called it the Parental Rights, the Student Privacy, and the Do No Harm Act. And so, whenever we talk about the parental rights, we basically say that, you know, that the parents need to know what's going on in the schools.
Yes.
If there is a situation where a student is confiding something to their teacher or to their counselor, then it's their legal, I mean, I was going to say moral and ethical, but at this point, it's going to be their legal responsibility to inform the parents.
Mm-hmm.
you know, if there's concerns about whether or not they think that they're a boy that was born in a girl's body, or, you know, or if they are, you know, they think that they're a cat born in a child's body, then it's going to be the responsibility of that counselor to communicate to that parent. They will no longer have the protection of not communicating that information to the parents. And I think that that's so very important, that the parents have those rights returned back to them.
Yeah, because it's not, I think we have to keep the foundation of, it's not the school system or it's not the state raising our children. We're raising our children.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. And, you know, they'll say, oh, but the parents don't want to get involved. Well, I agree that there are some parents that don't want to get involved, but don't treat the rest of us like that. Because 80 to 90% of us want to be involved. We want to know what's going on in our children. We want to know. We are concerned about their mental, physical, spiritual, you know, health. And keep us involved. Keep us posted. So from now on, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm just going to throw this out, too. A lot of people say, well, what's the governor going to do with this Senate Bill 150? And quite honestly, I don't know. I really don't know. You know, I'm not privy to the conversations between he and his cabinet members. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you know, sometimes when I think he's going to veto a bill, he doesn't. And sometimes when I think that he's not going to, that this is a safe bill, he vetoes it. So I'm really not sure, you know, sometimes what their logic is. But, I'm, you know, I'm sure they have a logical reason for why they do what they do. But I'm not sure what he's going to do with this, especially since, you know, this is a campaign year. And a lot of people will say that, well, you guys are just doing this just to bait the governor. You're just doing this. And I will fervently disagree with that. We are just doing this because we know that we are behind time for us to return those parental rights back to the parents.
Yes, ma'am. And I mean, that's important because, you know, was it Virginia that when the parents were throwing a uproar about not being able to talk and not having a say in what was being shown to their kids at school or what books are there, basically there was a fish who basically responded back, well, you don't have a say in what your parents are being taught at school.
Well, exactly, and not only that, but I believe it was the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, that came back and said that the parents that were showing up at these school board meetings, that they were should be considered to be domestic terrorists.
Yes, they did.
They retract that quickly because of the uproar, but to be called domestic terrorists because you're going to a school board meeting to talk about how your concerns for your children.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, what, you know, we know. I was going to say, what kind of nation do we have right now? What kind of administration do we have right now? But we know what it is. Mm-hmm. We know what the state of the administration is right now.
Yes. Well, can I ask a personal question that I'm inquisitive of? Because I've been asking anybody with an ear to hear who has a official position that would may be able to have insight in it. Our foster care system. I'm in the mm-hmm. middle of adopting 4 from the foster care right now. And we never really wanted to be foster parents, but we was going to adopt these kiddos, so we had to become foster parents to do that. But when I became a foster parent, I've realized just how broken the system is.
Sure.
I mean, it is. I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy to walk through this process with the state. And I know that Steve Meredith has been working on as a committee chair, I think he is, to work on the oversight of it, of the system a little bit, and look at some, I guess, kind of do like an audit almost in a sense. I've read where he's releasing reports and stuff like that. But has the system been addressed behind the scenes?
Yeah. So what you're talking about is that there was a task force that was created that was tasked with, I'll use that word redundantly, but anyway, they were tasked with looking at all the responsibilities of the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. Mm-hmm. I mean, this cabinet is, you know, just
huge.
It's massive.
Yes.
And then, you know, and I think that it's, I don't even know, like 45% of our state precious dollars go through, are spent on health and family services. And then, I don't even remember how many billions of dollars of federal money pass through the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. Mm-hmm. So it's just this huge conglomerate of responsibilities that's just been added on year after year after year. And so whenever I first got elected, I had the opportunity to go to meet most of the people or to meet with the different departments in Health and Family Services. And as I was going through, you know, I started asking everybody, well, how long have you been here? And the answer was 20, 25, 30 years. And so, you know, at some point, people just get bogged down with what they're doing and with, I think, truly with the burden of what they're carrying. So Senator Meredith was part of that task force, and they were supposed to go through and look at each one of the responsibilities and determine if there was a better way or a better place for those responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Yet whenever he got into that, as they were, he and the rest of the task force members, as they were going through that, then, you know, they started making recommendations. And, of course, the response, people don't like change.
No.
But the response was, oh, no, you can't change that. You can't change that. You can't change that. And so it's almost like this thing, while we had this huge yoke around our neck, we are so fearful of change. So a lot of we made some, you know, not very significant changes, but there were some changes that were made this year. But I will tell you that it's going to be the first of many. You know, mm-hmm. this the task force will continue to work on and continue to address all the issues that were cited with this department. And I'm always, you know, anytime when you're in a process improvement mode, you don't make all the changes the first year, but you continue to improve and then you build upon your improvement. And I'm quite confident that, you know, within the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, we're going to see some very significant changes in that department.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's needed because I know, like, even right now, I mean, within our own situation, in reality, if you're running a business, the speed of what we moved is just completely unfathomable.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I think I mentioned this once before. You know, whenever President Trump was in office, he implemented the Family First Act. Mm-hmm. And the Family First Act was to go to as many extremes as possible, to go to the extreme to try to keep family members together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that executive order was passed with extremely good intentions. You know, we do all want our families to be kept together.
Sure.
And yet at the same time, there has to be a realization that at what point do families not be kept together? So I think that that's what we're suffering from in Kentucky. We were the very first group under Governor Bevin to adopt the Family First policy. And so there's been a major disconnect, though, between the executive branch here in Kentucky and the legislative branch. I think it was last year. So it goes back. This was 2019 when the Family First Act was implemented in Kentucky, 2019. And last year I asked the committee members for the Health and Family Services and the Child and Welfare Oversight, which I was members on both of those committees, I asked the members if they had seen the Family First Act policy that was implemented under Governor Bevin and then modified under Governor Beshear, and there was not a single legislator that had seen what the executive branch had proposed and was in the process of implementing.
Yeah.
So in committee, I even asked, you know, the executive branch, the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, if they had involved any legislators in what they were implementing in Kentucky. And, of course, the response was no. So how in the world can you try to implement something under the federal government without having any type of legislative oversight, I mean, even if nothing else from a financial perspective?
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, if there was not legislative participation, if nothing else from the budgetary perspective, then of course you're doomed to failure from the very beginning.
Yeah. Well, for me, like, I know my own personal story, and I hope I'm not divulging too much because I don't know. I'm not saying names or nothing like that. I just know, like, within my own personal story, I understand reunification, but, you know, you have this thing called TPR. Once TPR happens, you have a 30-day thing, and then you're supposed to be moved over. I was almost 4 months late after the 30-day probationary period before I even got the adoption process started. And in my opinion, what we do, because I'm not the only one. I've heard person after person whose story's the same thing. The agency are telling me this is probably going to happen. Don't get frustrated. Don't get this. But what we're doing is we're when the kid does get to that position to where they're now able to have a new home, we're ripping time from a family that could be solid. And these kids need to move transitionally from the thought of I'm in limbo to I have a home. Mm-hmm. And I think that whenever it's 4 months delayed, and this isn't a one-time thing, this is person after person. And I just have a fear the kids are the ones suffering at this point.
Absolutely. Of course they are. I totally agree with you. You know, I talked to one young lady that finally aged out of the foster care program without being adopted, but she aged out. And I'm not even going to, it doesn't even really matter. She aged out at 18. She did. And so it doesn't really matter what time she got into the foster care program. By the time she aged out, she had been with 21 families.
Gosh.
Yeah. So even if she started the foster care program when she was an infant, that means that she was with a different family every year of her life. She was packing up her meager belongings in a garbage bag and moving to... Yeah, absolutely. Breaks your heart. And that's a totally, totally unacceptable. We're absolutely failing these children. And so I think we're making some strides. We, you know, in a process improvement, we don't want to do anything rash because you don't want to change, you know, you don't want to make anything worse. But by all means, we're trying to be pragmatic and strategic. And, Senator Meredith being on that committee is the perfect place for him to be.
Yeah. I know I don't want to drag it out. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I do know a story, too, of a girl. She lived with the same family for 2 years, and they were adopting this girl. And honestly, the state drug their feet at such a space, and there was no really big hiccups. It's just they were dragging their feet with this, and finally the girl got to the point where she was at the age where she could age out. She said, I'm just done. I'm not doing this no more. I'm not dragging it out. I'm not going through the – I'm tired of it. Mm-hmm. And she aged out and went to I think she went to the other side of what basic life skills and what's it called, transitional living kind of deal.
Yeah,
and
that's
she
right.
just – I mean, she had a chance to have a home. Mm-hmm. And she lost. Sure. And she gave up on it because she never thought it was going to happen because she had gone mm-hmm. through the system for so long. And your heart does break for kids because that should be the intent of the system. Is if you can't reunify, you get these kids into a solid home.
You know, and talking about, I totally agree with you. And so we were talking about, you know, we were talking about the Health and Family Services Department, how that needs to be, you know, just totally reworked because it's just not, it's so big and it's so cumbersome and it just seems like it's not working. But what you just referring to was the judicial branch. And as far as I'm concerned, the judicial branch is just as bad.
Yeah.
I feel sorry, really feel sorry for the social workers. I feel sorry for everyone who is involved in this process because it seems like it has just gotten to the point where it's just, I mean, people have emotionally checked out because all they can do is just rubber stamp the next, you know, rubber stamp. And it's just, we have to have people that... We have to have a process in place where people aren't forced to emotionally check out, you know, because these are people that we're talking about. And with the people that we're talking about, then therefore they deserve the best interest, people to have the best interest and not to just rubber stamp their lives and the decisions that are being made for their lives.
Yes, because there's been so many people, people that stepped into that field because their heart was to help kids and they leave within a year or two because they cannot stand they can't deal with it. And they'll go and find a different job within the field to help kids. But I've heard so many people who just say, we're not helping kids. We are not.
Yeah, we're not. No, we're just pushing them around. We're just, you know, just like doing the big paper push and moving them around. It's the process. I'm absolutely not going to blame it on the people. It's the process. And
it
so
is.
Therefore, we have got to modify this process. And I think we're moving toward in that direction, but it's not going to happen quickly. It's going to, but we truly need an executive branch and a governor who's interested in doing those studies and being willing to change and not taking the suggestions for change as a personal affront to him or to her, whoever our next governor ends up being.
And I do think it's important to get people, I mean, I'm not trying to say me, but like people who's been through this who's really walked practically in there, to say, this is what it feels like from our side too. Like, this is what, you know, and we need good foster parents, because if we're going to be a pro-life state, that's going to be, pro-life doesn't end when they're born. Pro-life is after they're born too. And if we're going to preach against adoption, we better preach for, I mean, if we're going to preach against abortion, we better preach for adoption. And we have to make this more accessible, and we have to get better foster parents in there. I mean, we have to get people.
That's exactly right. And a lot of people say, well, it's just too expensive. It's just too expensive. Actually, it's really not expensive, you know, and you can probably attest to that. You know, going from the foster care program into adoption is not expensive, other than just your time. It takes time and effort. It takes forever, to your point. Now, if you want to go to a private adoption, now, of course, now you're talking where it's $30,000 to $40,000.
Yes, ma'am.
But again, you know, through the foster care program, it needs to be not just, again, it doesn't need to just be something that's real quick and, you know, there's not the vetting that's done.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
But if we've already vetted good parents and good families and good homes, then those opportunities need to be taken advantage of as quickly as possible.
Amen. Well, Miss Nancy, you never disappoint. Every time I've ever talked to you, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I thank you so much for doing what you do.
Well, thank you very much. I always enjoy it, and I think I'm supposed to be on last week. And, you know, for whatever reason, when we're in the middle of session, I mean, it's just like I call this the Frankfurt. I just call it my fishbowl, and I have a tendency of just forgetting about the rest of the world. So I apologize, but
no,
please don't
fine.
Ever hesitate to invite me back, because I always enjoy talking to you and your audience.
Well, thank you, and we're still in prayer for the Sierra House and all that is happening over there. So really appreciate you all doing that ministry.
Well, thank you very much. And to answer one of your questions earlier, we're not out of session yet. We've still got the 29th and the 30th, and we'll review anything that the governor has vetoed, and we'll look at why he just, you know, his justification for vetoing. And occasionally we have said, oh, my goodness, he's right. We did miss something. And occasionally we'll go, nope, he's, you know, we don't agree with him, and we'll do the veto override. So do not stop the prayers for this session, because we need, you know, we still have to stay strong to finish the race on the 29th and the 30th.
Amen. Well, you got them. Appreciate you guys. You have a blessed day. We'll hear from you soon.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're out of here for this morning. Thank you guys so much for joining in with us on this morning with Box 2 Monday edition. It is March the 20th. You'll never have another March the 20th as long as you live. So go live the kingdom for the glory of God. We love you guys. Be blessed. We'll be back tomorrow, 7 a.m. Central Time, here on Mornings of Box 2 Radio on the Box 2 Radio Network.